Thanks, guys. Tim, alcoholic. Amen. All right, so we finished up with our 164 pages last week. We are going to do Dr. Bob's Nightmare. I do think it does make sense since we do Bill's story. So let's take a real quick look at page 165. So tonight will be the finishing of the winter 2015, spring 2016 cycle. And I think it's been an absolute pleasure for me. I hope it's been something for you guys also. And with that, on page 165, we do see that it says personal stories, how 42 alcoholics recovered from their malady. And the beginning with the story of Dr. Bob, a co-founder of AA, there are here presented three groups of personal histories. So we see here it says there are 42 alcoholic recovered stories, but there's actually 43 in the book because we have to count Bill's, right? Which is page one of the book, right? So let's turn to the next page. And it breaks the stories up into three parts. The pioneers, so these are all the crew that came in first. And then part two, they stopped in time. I think it'd be safe to call that the high bottom guys. And then the part three, they lost nearly all, and we'll call those the low bottom guys. So that being said, we'll go to the next page. And it says, part one, pioneers of AA. Dr. Bob and the nine men and women who are here tell their stories where among the early members of AA's first groups. All 10 have now passed away of natural causes, having maintained complete sobriety. Today, hundreds of additional AA members can be found who have had no relapse for more than 50 years. All of these, then, are the pioneers of AA. They bear witness that release from alcoholism can really be permanent. So if you don't mind, just play with this for a second with me. Let's go back to Roman numeral 5. Roman numeral 5, V. At the bottom of the page there, you do see it says Dr. Bob's Nightmare on page 171, which is where we're going to start tonight. This, of course, is Dr. Bob's story. On the following page, Roman numeral VI, we have Alcoholics Anonymous number 3. This is Bill Dotson. We talked to him. You're in the Roman numeral, Steve?
No.
I see.
No.
I saw that look on your face, buddy. Yes. I've been there, my friend. So Alcoholics Anonymous number 3 is Bill Dotson. Gratitude in Action, as it says right there, is the story of Dave B., founder of AA in Canada, I think Montreal specifically. Women Suffer Too, Marty Mann, Mrs. Marty Mann. And our southern friend, Fitz Mayo, founder of AA Washington, right? And the vicious cycle, which is Jimmy Burwell, responsible for what we've added into steps 3 and 11, God as we understood him, and also instrumental in highlighting third tradition. We have Jim's story. This is Jim Scott. He was a physician, first black group in Washington D.C., the Cosmopolitan Group. Interesting little piece of trivia there, right? The man who mastered fear, Archie Trowbridge, started AA Detroit. He sold himself short, started AA Chicago, Earl Treat, and was assisted very ably in the Keys of the Kingdom by Sylvia Kaufman, first AA intergroup secretary. The reason we just did that little exercise was I am just referring to what I read originally, which said all 10 have now passed away of natural causes, having maintained complete sobriety. And for those of you who are trivia hounds, both gratitude in, Women Suffer Too, Marty Mann, and our southern friend did have at least one slip. So, and I merely say that just so that we are as factual as we can possibly be, right? They all came right back, and they all had a wonderful AA career, but good to be honest, right? Which one? Sylvia Kaufman, The Keys of the Kingdom? Sylvia Kaufman was a socialite when came down to Akron, and Oxford Group wives wanted her to go back immediately. She was a divorcee, good-looking, had money, and they thought that this would cause this would cause a little bit of ruckus. And got sober and sent back right away. Ended up going back to Chicago and assisted Earl Treat in setting up AA Chicago. She was, as I said, the first AA intergroup secretary. More accurately, her assistant did much of the work, but it was her job. You understand what I'm saying? Okay, good. So, here we go. We're on page 171. That was just a warm-up. Did you want a book? So, there we go. We have so many. Dr. Bob's Nightmare, a co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous. The birth of our society dates from his first day of permanent sobriety, June 10th, 1935. To 1950, the year of his death, he carried the AA message to more than 5,000 alcoholic men and women. And to all these, he gave his medical services without thought of charge. So you know how that worked, right? He would get you somehow into the hospital. So Sister Ignatia would get you into the hospital, and then he would see you for your alcoholism. That was not on the clock. If you needed a cardiologist, somebody in the hospital, a cardiologist, would see you and charge you appropriately. But Dr. Bob did not charge you for your alcoholic stay. You did not get a bill from Dr. Bob, right? In this prodigy of service, he was well assisted by Sister Ignatia at St. Thomas Hospital in Akron, Ohio, one of the greatest friends our fellowship will ever know. So originally, Dr. Bob starts out in Akron City Hospital and eventually ends up in St. Thomas Hospital, okay? Dr. Bob's date of birth is 1879, and of course he dies in 1950, gets sober in 35, stays sober until death, right? And what also is interesting there is it says the birth of our society dates from his first day of permanent sobriety, June 10th, 1935. There are two ways to count your sobriety, right? We know this, right? You can count after you've been sober 24 hours. I'm sober now, 24, I'm sober a day. This is not the case here. This is counting from when he surrendered. So we know that this is the day he did that surgery. Remember, he had to do the surgery again? And he drank that morning and had a goofball that morning. But he surrendered that day and went out and made his amends. So you can see you can count it both ways. Down. Down. No, you said goofball. I just... Goofball. Yeah, great. So, I was born in a small New England village of about 7,000 souls. So they're talking about St. Johnsbury, 100 miles north of Manchester. The general moral standard was, as I recall it, far above the average. No beer or liquor was sold in the neighborhood, except at the state liquor agency, where perhaps one might procure a pint if he could convince the agent that he really needed it. Without this proof, the expectant purchaser would be forced to depart empty-handed with none of what I later came to believe was the great panacea for all human ills. Men who had liquor shipped in from Boston or New York by express were looked upon with great distrust and disfavor by most of the good townspeople. The town was well supplied with churches and schools in which I pursued my early educational activities. My father was a professional man of recognized ability, and both my father and mother were most active in church affairs. So we are, of course, talking about Susan and Walter Smith, and that's Dr. Bob's mother and father, and his father was a judge. Both father and mother were considerably above the average in intelligence. I like this next line. Unfortunately for me, I was the only child, which perhaps engendered the selfishness which played such an important part in bringing on my alcoholism. What's the exact nature of our illness? Selfish self-centeredness, right? I thought it's interesting that he got that into the story here. From childhood through high school, I was more or less forced to go to church, Sunday school, and evening service, Monday night Christian endeavor, and sometimes to Wednesday evening prayer meeting. This had the effect of making me resolve that when I was free from parental domination, I would never again darken the doors of a church. This resolution I kept steadfastly for the next 40 years, except when circumstances made it seem unwise to absent myself. After high school came, 4 years in one of the best colleges in the country, where drinking seemed to be a major extracurricular activity. What's his university?
Dartmouth.
Ivy League school, Hanover, New Hampshire, right over the line from Vermont. Makes perfect sense, right? Almost everyone seemed to do it. He was there from 1899 to 1902 at Dartmouth. I did it more and more and had lots of fun without much grief, either physical or financial. I seemed to be able to snap back the next morning better than most of my fellow drinkers who were cursed, or perhaps blessed, with a great deal of morning after nausea. Never once in my life have I had a headache, which fact leads me to believe that I was an alcoholic almost from the start. I think this is a better measurement, this next sentence. My whole life seemed to be centered around doing what I wanted to do, without regard for the rights, wishes, or privileges for anyone else, a state of mind which became more and more predominant as the years passed. I think that's a great precursor to the future. Selfish, self-centered. I was graduated summa cum laude in the eyes of the drinking fraternity, but not in the eyes of the dean. The next 3 years I spent in Boston, Chicago, and Montreal in the employ of a large manufacturing concern, selling railway supplies, gas engines of all sorts, and many other items of heavy hardware. During these years, I drank as much as my purse permitted, still without paying too great a penalty, although I was beginning to have morning jitters at times. Now, this means he graduated at 21. He's talking 3 years later. That makes him 24 at most. He's already got morning jitters. I'd say that's pretty significant, even though it's being downplayed there a little. I lost only a half day's work during these 3 years. My next move was to take up the study of medicine, entering one of the largest universities in the country. We named Michigan University. He was there 1905 to 1907. He did not graduate from there. He went on to another school. 1905, 1907, medical school, Michigan University. There I took up the business of drinking with much greater earnestness than I had previously shown. Progression. On account of my enormous capacity for beer, I was elected to membership in one of the drinking societies and soon became one of the leading spirits. Many mornings I have gone to classes and, even though fully prepared, would turn and walk back to the fraternity house because of my jitters, not daring to enter the classroom for fear of making a scene should I be called on for recitation. This went from bad to worse until sophomore spring when, after a prolonged period of drinking, I made up my mind that I would not complete my course. So I packed my grip and went south to spend a month on a large farm owned by a friend of mine. When I got the fog out of my brain, I decided that quitting school was very foolish and that I had better return and continue my work. When I reached school, I discovered the faculty had other ideas on the subject. After much argument, they allowed me to return and take my exams, all of which I passed credibly. But they were much disgusted and told me they would attempt to struggle along without my presence. After many painful discussions, they finally gave me my credits, and I migrated to another of the leading universities of the country and entered as a junior that fall. School?
Rush.
Rush Medical in Chicago. So he gets in there at 1907, and he ends up graduating from there. There, my drinking became so much worse that the boys in the fraternity house where I lived felt forced to send for my father, who made a long journey in the vain endeavor to get me straightened around. This had little effect, however, for I kept on drinking and used a great deal more hard liquor than in former years. So again, we're seeing progression here, right? And you know how bad you have to be if the guys in the fraternity house say you got a problem, right? They're calling your father, you know? And at this point, you're about 26, 27 years old. You're not a kid. Here he's 26, 27, right? Coming up to final exams, I went on a particularly strenuous spree. When I went in to write the examinations, my hand trembled so I could not hold a pencil. I passed in at least 3 absolutely blank books. I was, of course, soon on the carpet, and the upshot was that I had to go back for 2 more quarters and remain absolutely dry if I wished to graduate. This I did, and proved myself satisfactory to the faculty, both in deportment and scholastically. So he ends up graduating in 1910. I conducted myself so credibly that I was able to secure a much-coveted internship in a western city, Akron, Ohio, where I spent 2 years. During these 2 years, I was kept so busy that I hardly left the hospital at all, Akron City Hospital. Consequently, I could not get into any trouble. When those 2 years were up, I opened an office downtown. I had some money, all the time in the world, and considerable stomach trouble. I soon discovered that a couple of drinks would alleviate my gastric distress, at least for a couple of hours at a time. So it was not at all difficult for me to return to my former excessive indulgence. By this time, I was beginning to pay very dearly physically, and in hope of relief, voluntarily incarcerated myself at least a dozen times, more than a dozen times, in one of the local sanitariums. So the sanitarium is Fair Oaks Villa. This is detox. This is like a 5-day gig, right? I was between Scylla and Charybdis now, because if I did not drink, my stomach tortured me. And if I did, my nerves did the same thing. So let's just look at this reference for a second. This is from Greek mythology. And basically it means two evils, right? And in more modern language, it would be the same as saying a rock in a hard place. You're screwed either way, right? After 3 years of this, I wound up in the local hospital where they attempted to help me out. But I would get my friends to smuggle me a quart, or I would steal the alcohol about the building so that I got rapidly worse. He's referring to People's Hospital here. So the other thing is a sanitarium, drying out facility. Now he's literally in a hospital, but he's not going to Akron City Hospital. He's an attending physician there. So he's at People's Hospital. Finally, my father had to send a doctor out from my hometown. So we're in St. Johnsbury, Vermont, and he's sending them all the way to Akron, Ohio, right? Finally, my father had to send a doctor out from my hometown who managed to get me back there in some way. And I was in bed about 2 months before I could venture out of the house. I stayed about town a couple of months more and then returned to resume my practice. So he's basically gone back home to St. Johnsbury for 4 months, right? This is in 1914. I think I must have been thoroughly scared by what had happened, or by the doctor, or probably both, so that I did not touch a drink again until the country went dry. So this is 1914. Prohibition starts in 1920. He doesn't drink for 6 years. Prohibition, the 18th Amendment, lasts from 1920 to 1933. With the passing of the 18th Amendment, I felt quite safe. I knew everyone would buy a few bottles or cases of liquor as their exchequers permitted, and that it would soon be gone. Exchequers is your bank account. Therefore, it would make no great difference even if I should do some drinking. At that time, I was not aware of the almost unlimited supply the government made it possible for us doctors to obtain. Neither had I any knowledge of the bootlegger who soon appeared on the horizon. I drank with moderation at first, but it took me only a relatively short time to drift back into the old habits, which had wound up so disastrously before. So we learn here, once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. We see that again. During the next few years, I developed two distinct phobias. One was the fear of not sleeping, and the other was the fear of running out of liquor. Sounds like one part of the illness, right? Mental obsession. Not being a man of means, I knew that if I did not stay sober enough to earn money, I would run out of liquor. Most of the time, therefore, I did not take the morning drink, which I craved so badly, but instead would fill up on large doses of sedatives to quiet the jitters, which distressed me terribly. So I just wanted to highlight for a second, he is using the word here, craved, in the mental sense, not as the same thing as saying phenomenon of craving. Phenomenon of craving can only happen after you take booze into your body. Here, he's using it as the same as mental obsession. But when you say phenomenon, observable craving, you're talking about the physicality of the illness. Okay? Occasionally, I would yield to the morning craving, but if I did, it would be only a few hours before I would be quite unfit for work. This would lessen my chances of smuggling some home that evening, which in turn would mean a night of futile tossing around in bed, followed by a morning of unbearable jitters. So what this is letting us know here, why he has fear here, it didn't say it, but he's gotten married here. So smuggling at home was to get it past Anne. So he gets married in 1915. During the subsequent 15 years, I had sense enough never to go to the hospital if I had been drinking, and very seldom did I receive patients. I would sometimes hide out in one of the clubs of which I was a member, and had the habit at times of registering at a hotel under a fictitious name. But my friends usually found me, and I would go home if they promised that I should not be scolded. If my wife was planning to go out in the afternoon, I would get a large supply of liquor and smuggle it home and hide it in the coal bin, the clothes chute, over door jams, over beams in the cellar, and in cracks in the cellar tile. I also made use of old trunks and chests, the old can container, and even the ash container. The water tank on the toilet I never used because that looked too easy. I found out later that my wife inspected it frequently. I used to put 8 or 12 ounce bottles of alcohol in a fur-lined glove and toss it onto the back airing porch when winter days got dark enough. My bootlegger had hidden alcohol at the back steps where I could get it at my convenience. Sometimes I would bring it in my pockets, but they were inspected, and that became too risky. I used also to put it up in 4 ounce bottles and stick several in my stocking tops. This worked nicely until my wife and I went to see Wallace Beery in Tugboat Annie, after which the pant leg and stocking racket were out. I will not take space to relate all my hospital or sanitarium experiences. So now he's just told us about at least a dozen plus the People's Hospital, but he doesn't want to burden us with any more. So you can just imagine the number we're talking about, right? During all this time, we became more or less ostracized by our friends. We could not be invited out because I would surely get tight, and my wife dared not invite people in for the same reason. My phobia for sleeplessness demanded that I get drunk every night. But in order to get more liquor for the next night, I had to stay sober during the day, at least up to 4 o'clock. This routine went on with few interruptions for 17 years. It was really a horrible nightmare. This earning money, getting liquor, smuggling it home, getting drunk, morning jitters, taking large doses of sedatives to make it possible for me to earn more money and go on ad nauseum. I used to promise my wife, my friends, and my children that I would drink no more, promises which seldom kept me sober even through the day, though I was very sincere when I made them. For the benefit of those experimentally inclined, I should mention the so-called beer experiment. When beer first came back, 1933, I thought that I was safe. I could drink all I wanted of that. It was harmless. No one ever got drunk on beer, so I filled the cellar full with the permission of my good wife. It was not long before I was drinking at least a case and a half a day. I put on 30 pounds of weight in about 2 months, looked like a pig, and was uncomfortable from shortness of breath. It then occurred to me that after one was all smelled up with beer, no one could tell what had been drunk. So I began to fortify my beer with straight alcohol. Of course, the result was very bad, and that ended the beer experiment. About the time of the beer experiment, I was thrown in with a crowd of people who attracted me because of their seeming poise, health, and happiness. This is the Oxford Group. We're now in 1933. They spoke with great freedom from embarrassment, which I could never do, and they seemed very much at ease on all occasions and appeared very healthy. More than these attributes, they seemed to be happy. I was self-conscious and ill at ease most of the time. My health was at the breaking point, and I was thoroughly miserable. I sensed they had something I did not have, and from which I might readily profit. I learned it was something of a spiritual nature, which did not appeal to me very much, but I thought it could do no harm. I gave the matter much time and study for the next 2.5 years. So he's up to 1935 now, and he's not gotten sober on church. But I still got tight every night nevertheless. I read everything I could find and talked to everyone who I thought knew anything about it. Can we take a guess at what's the prime reason he didn't, Bill basically gets it in the Oxford group. Bill's at this point sober about 6 months. He's in the Oxford group 2.5 years. Why is he not successful? I love that he's drinking. Well, it's actually because he can't be honest. He has not told the group. It's a Wednesday night meeting. Remember T. Henry and Clarice Williams' home? They'd go every Wednesday night, so it's a big group. It's all Oxford group gig. And he cannot tell everybody in the room that his problem is really booze. So honesty, right, H-O-W, honesty, he can't get past it. My wife became deeply interested, and it was her interest that sustained mine, though I had no time sensed that it might be an answer to my liquor problem. How my wife kept her faith and courage during all those years, I'll never know, but she did. If she had not, I know I would have been dead a long time ago. For some reason, we alcoholics seem to have the gift of picking out the world's finest women. Why they should be subjected to the tortures we inflict upon them, I cannot explain. About this time, a lady called up my wife one Saturday afternoon, saying she wanted me to come over that evening to meet a friend of hers who might help me. So we're talking about Henrietta Seiberling. It was the day before Mother's Day, and I had come home plastered, carrying a big potted plant, which I had set down on the table, and forthwith went upstairs and passed out. The next day, she called again, wishing to be polite. Though I felt very badly, I said, let's make the call, and extracted from my wife a promise that we would not stay over 15 minutes. We entered her house at exactly 5 o'clock, and it was 11:15 when we left. So that's a six-hour visit. And who's in the house with Henrietta?
Bill.
I had a couple of shorter talks with this man afterward and stopped drinking abruptly. This dry spell lasted for about 3 weeks. Then I went to Atlantic City to attend several days meeting of a national society of which I was a member. This is the AMA meeting in Atlantic City, and he had gone to every year for 20 years, and he felt as though I'm sober now, I could handle it, I'm going. He's drunk on the train going down. Like, that's how quick it happened, right? I drank all the scotch they had on the train and bought several quarts on my way to the hotel. This was on Sunday. I got tight that night, stayed sober Monday until after the dinner, and then proceeded to get tight again. I drank all I dared in the bar and then went to my room to finish the job. Tuesday, I started in the morning, getting well organized by noon. I did not want to disgrace myself, so I then checked out. I bought some more liquor on the way to the depot. I had to wait some time for the train. I remember nothing from then on until I woke up at a friend's house in a town near home. So this is his receptionist's house, Lily. Her husband Everett and Lily went to pick him up at the depot, drunk as a skunk, and brought him back to their house for him to sleep overnight, right? These good people notified my wife, who sent my newly made friend, Bill Wilson, over to get me. He came and got me home and to bed, gave me a few drinks that night, and one bottle of beer the next morning. That was June 10th, 1935, and that was my last drink. As I write, nearly 4 years have passed. The question which might naturally come into your mind would be, what did the man do or say that was different from what others had done or said? It must be remembered that I had read a great deal and talked to everyone who knew or thought they knew anything about the subject of alcoholism. But this was a man who had experienced many years of frightful drinking, who had had most all the drunkard's experiences known to man, but who had been cured by the very means I had been trying to employ, that is to say, the spiritual approach. He gave me information about the subject of alcoholism, which was undoubtedly helpful. So that's the Silkworth information of mental physical. But watch italics now. Of far more importance was the fact that he was the first living human with whom I had ever talked who knew what he was talking about in regard to alcoholism from actual experience. In other words, he talked my language. He knew all the answers, and certainly not because he picked them up in his reading. It is a most wonderful blessing to be relieved of the terrible curse with which I was afflicted. My health is good, and I have regained my self-respect and the respect of my colleagues. My home life is ideal, and my business is as good as can be expected in these uncertain times. I spend a great deal of time passing on what I learned to others who want and need it badly. I do it for four reasons. One, sense of duty. Two, it is a pleasure. Three, because in so doing, I am paying my debt to the man who took time to pass it on to me. Four, because every time I do it, I take out a little more insurance for myself against a possible slip. Unlike most of our crowd, I did not get over my craving for liquor much during the first 2.5 years of abstinence. It was almost always with me, but at no time have I been anywhere near yielding. I used to get terribly upset when I saw my friends drink and knew I could not. But I schooled myself to believe that though I once had the same privilege, I had abused it so frightfully that it was withdrawn. So it doesn't behoove me to squawk about it, for, after all, no one ever had to throw me down and pour liquor down my throat. If you think you are an atheist, an agnostic, a skeptic, or have any other form of intellectual pride which keeps you from accepting what is in this book, I feel sorry for you. If you still think you are strong enough to beat the game alone, that is your affair. But if you really and truly want to quit drinking liquor for good and all, and sincerely feel that you must have some help, we know that we have an answer for you. It never fails if you go about it with one half the zeal you have been in the habit of showing when you were getting another drink. Your heavenly Father will never let you down.